Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with Nancy Goldstone, author of The Maid and the Queen, The Secret History of Joan of Arc, and Amy Kirk Duvoisin, founder of the Joan of Arc Project and captain of the crew de Jeanne d'Arc. They're here to talk about the 5th annual Salon de Jeanne d'Arc. We'll also hear from Wayne Everard, who's curating a new exhibit at the New Orleans Public Library's main library, From Common and Basin to Tulane and Loyola, 150 years of change in our neighborhood. Amy Kirk Duvoisin is founder of the Joan of Arc Project and captain of the crew of Jeanne d'Arc. She's here to talk about the 5th annual Salon, which will be held Saturday, September 20th, from 11 to 4 at the Dana Center at Loyola University, hosted by the Loyola Medieval Studies Program. One of the featured speakers at that salon is the wonderful writer Nancy Goldstone, who's joining us by phone from New York. I first encountered and madly enjoyed Nancy's work in Used and Rare, Adventures in the Rare Book Trade, written with her husband, Lawrence Goldstone. But she has spent 10 years learning about medieval history and will be at the Salon to talk about her book, The Maid and the Queen, The Secret History of Joan of Arc. Welcome, Nancy.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be on.
And Amy, so nice to have you here.
Thank you very much.
So, Amy, let's start with the crew. You began a Joan of Arc book club when the crew first started, and you're hoping to revive it with Nancy's book this time.
I am. Nancy's book has been such an inspiration for me to start rereading more about Joan because, let's face it, there's a lot of Joan of Arc books out there, and not all of them are great, but they're great to read because there's always a little something different, or just to be reminded of her story is always inspirational. But Nancy's book is the first book since I started The Crew in 2008 that I read that made me say, oh, we need to keep studying Joan, and there's more to the story. And, you know, believe it or not, I'm by absolutely no means a scholar, but people would come up to me and ask me questions about Joan at the parade. Of course, we had the salons every year where we had experts talk about Joan. And our salons had tended to be more about localized things about Joan, you know, about the Joan of Arc statue in the French Quarter. And there would be something always from the Loyola Medieval Studies program about Joan's time. But we really never studied a book, frankly, at any of the salons because there hadn't been anything new or exciting written about her. And although we had this book club in 2010, we were reading things like Mark Twain's Joan of Arc. I mean, we were reading some of the so-called classics and another one by a French author that was considered a good one by scholars. So when I found this book, it was actually the inspiration for us to create a new character in the parade, to have a Queen Yolande. So we now have a queen, and we give her this book actually as a gift.
Oh, great.
And that's one of the reasons I thought it would be the book for the salon to kind of bring us back to that sense of scholarship and learning about her, because as these queens will be on our third Queen Yolande this year for 2015, as we would tell them Queen Yolande's story, because they really didn't know about her. I mean, some of the folks in our parade really barely knew anything about Joan, so that's part of the reason for the salon. But Queen Yolande is still a mystery. So when we would sit down with these amazing women in the New Orleans community who we'd nominated to play her, we had to educate her about Queen Yolande. And so we would give her this book, and we always had these just great discussions, almost these mini salons, about Nancy's work and the unveiling of this great story about who was really behind Joan and what made it possible. So we feel like it's the perfect book to kind of revive a book club and also make the salon a little bit more academic, perhaps, than it's been in a few years.
So, Nancy, did you know this crew existed?
No, but I think it's terrific when people put together information about Joan of Arc and try and really get her out there, because she is such an inspirational figure, it's true. But there's also so much to learn about her and to learn about her time.
So tell us about why your book is a secret history.
Well, it's secret because nobody has figured it out in 6 centuries, how it is that Joan came to know what she knew or how she came to the attention of the Dauphin. who was the heir to the throne of France and how she got to the court and what really happened to bring her to the attention of the war. So I did that in my book. And the reason that no one ever found this is that 99.99% of the people who write about Joan of Arc begin with Joan's birth, her story from her perspective. And, of course, from her perspective, she is exactly what she says she is. She is an ignorant peasant girl. Everything seems to be happening because her angels are making it happen, or she doesn't see anything from behind the scenes. When in reality, what is happening is that she is part of a much larger war effort, which is being run by the Dauphin's mother-in-law, Yolande of Aragon, Queen of Sicily. So she's the one who actually kind of recruits Joan and brings her in. And it's much more of an explainable story when you see it from Yolande's point of view.
And how do you find these women? I mean, how do you imagine them personally?
Yolande of Aragon is my hero and my heroine. If you want a piece of advice, Yolande of Aragon, she was the most experienced, competent politician and diplomat I have ever come across. And I've been studying women in history for over a decade now. And she just wipes the floor with everybody. All of her solutions are so intelligent, and she manages to make things happen. And the reason that nobody really has found her hand in underlying the whole Joan of Arc story is that she hid it so cleverly that even centuries later, people don't see it.
Oh, it's like that old thing, it doesn't matter who gets the credit as long as the job gets done.
Right, exactly.
And she knew how to raise an army. My God.
She did, because that was her job. She was Queen of Sicily. It was not a title that she'd never lived in Sicily. She lived in France. But first her husband and then her sons would have to try and go and conquer Sicily. And her job was to raise the armies and get the ships and get the supplies and all of this sort of thing. The Hundred Years' War with the Dauphin and raising the Siege of Orléans, this is kind of the war she had in her spare time. Her daughter was married to the Dauphin, and she wanted her to be Queen of France, and the Dauphin was not doing a great job with the war, so she accepted it. She was the equivalent of the medieval Secretary of War.
Oh, wow.
It was he who raised the army for the Orléans. He had no money, and he didn't know how to do it. So it was her expedition.
Sounds like she who must be obeyed. So,
Amy.
I was just thinking, that's what I love so much about this book, is you learn about the Dauphin in a way that no other book, I feel like, has covered. I mean, even his infancy and the strange travels that he was always getting packed up and sent away because they were about to be attacked. And you get this great sense of him, a better sense of him than I've gotten from any other book. And he is another great mystery in the Joan story. You just end up angry at him. Why didn't he save Joan? And you have all this bitterness about him. And you get a little bit more of, I wouldn't necessarily say sympathy, but you certainly get his whole story through Nancy's book, which makes me think we should give it to the king in our parade too, who plays Charles VII, and say, read more of this. But I think that's a really, really great thing about the book, is you get to understand Joan with these two characters that are always just, again, like Nancy said, in the background. It's always Joan's story, and then there's this Dauphin, all of a sudden she shows up with him, and you don't. Countless books I've tried to figure out the connections, the Hundred Years' War, and I think her book really does a great job of summarizing things in a way that's so dramatic, and the characters are in the forefront, so you get swept up in that. I love that, and I loved understanding, this relationship between the Dauphin and Queen Yolande. Joan's story makes so much more sense than her just showing up and saying, hey, I need an army.
So, Amy, tell us about some of the things that'll be happening at the Salon when Nancy's speaking about her book.
Well, we're going to start off the day actually talking about the library project that Amanda Helm, our membership and now library director, started. She's the reason that we got in touch directly with Nancy, because when Amanda was talking about presenting on the library project, we said we should probably have an emblematic book to encourage people to get the idea that there's still much to read. You think you've read everything about Joan, but you haven't. So Amanda called Nancy to see if she might write something for the library project and ended up inviting her to the Salon. So we're going to be talking about this collaboration with the New Orleans Public Library, where we've built a collection online of all music, film, and books about Joan that you can now get through the New Orleans Public Library. And then there's a presentation by some folks who presented at our first Salon, and it's time for them to come back. It's the Monumental Task Committee, and they focus focus on statues and historic monuments in New Orleans, and they're very committed to revitalizing and repairing the Joan of Arc statue, even though she looks fabulous when you pass her in the French Quarter. If you take a close look, there's some bolts missing, which is very strange. You don't want to think about a bolt missing in hurricane season. So they came and repaired that actually just 2 weeks ago. She needs some new gilding, and there's a bunch of other things. So this is an opportunity for people to come and learn about the history of the statue, which in and of itself is fascinating, how she came to be ours and moved around the city, as you know, and then giving some hands-on opportunities. And then Nancy is right in the middle of the day as our keynote. She'll be talking from 12:30 to 1:15, and then we have a couple of theatrical presentations. Students from Loyola will be presenting scenes from Henry VI, which you probably know is not the most flattering portrayal of Joan, which is why it's interesting. And I always joke, well, Shakespeare was British. If it's only a couple hundred years later, he's not going to be doing a great homage to Joan. So scenes from Shakespeare, and then a one-woman show by a company in South Carolina that found us and wanted to be part of this. And this woman wrote a one-woman show just for the salon that she'll be presenting. Right in between the two theatrical presentations, we have our mainstay, Dr. Sebastian, who he's the reason we're able to have this event at Loyola. He is associate professor of medieval literature, and he's been with us since the beginning of the salon. And every year he does something, whether it's about medieval music, other women in Joan's time. This year, I actually asked him specifically to talk about Twelfth Night, because I've always been curious about Twelfth Night in Joan's time. And maybe Nancy can also talk a little bit about her birthday being invented or not. Not that it was really invented, but we don't know exactly when she was born, but somewhere along the lines it was decided she was born on the Epiphany. So this works well for our parade being on Twelfth Night. But I'm curious what would have been going on in her time for the Epiphany and Twelfth Night. So
it's a rich full day.
Yes.
We've been talking with Nancy Goldstone, who's the author of The Maid and the Queen, The Secret History of Joan of Arc. She'll be the featured speaker at the 5th annual Salon de Joan d'Arc, and Amy Kirk Duvoisin, founder and crew captain. You can meet them Saturday, September 20th at the Salon at Loyola University. To register, check out joanofarcparade.com. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Lady Madonna, children at your feet.
Wayne Everard has retired as the New Orleans Public Library archivist, but they've lured him back to curate a special exhibit opening at the main library this month, mounted by the Louisiana Division and the City Archives staff. It's called From Common and Basin to Tulane and Loyola, 150 Years of Change in Our Neighborhood, and it chronicles the changes in the CBD around the main library. And there have been a lot. Wayne, welcome to The Reading Life.
It's good to be here, Susan.
Now, you know, you're one of those go-to guys for writers and historians, because if you don't know the answer yourself, you know where to find it.
Exactly.
So what was appealing about this topic and developing an exhibit around it?
It's a combination of things. The main thing, I guess, was the fact that one of the buildings that we feature in the exhibit is what used to be the Pythian Temple. It's a building on the corner of Loyola and Gravier, or Basin and Gravier, or Saratoga and Gravier, depending what time of the history you're talking about, that was built in 1909 by African-American businessmen, which to me, when I first learned that, just was amazing that in 1909, African-American businessmen in New Orleans were able to build a seven-story skyscraper. But they did it, and it was apparently a successful building. It has an interesting history. It didn't really last under their control that long, and it has changed along with the rest of the neighborhood over the years. You know, because they were doing this renovation, taking a 1950s facade off and restoring it back to the nice building that it was in 1909, that got me thinking about, well, what else has been going on in this neighborhood, you know, over the last 150 years or whatever, that has changed the way it looks, the way it acts, and everything else about it.
Now, when we think of the neighborhood around the main library, we think of it as under construction right now with all those streets. But in truth, it has been changing and evolving a lot over time. What are some of the big changes?
Well, probably the biggest change is just the whole Civic Center complex, of which the library is part. The entire area between the library and City Hall was filled up with old residential buildings, a few businesses, some churches, considered in the 1950s to be a slum and sort of a big urban renewal project of the time. The city bought up all the property, tore everything down, and built what we know today as the Civic Center. Right now, the only buildings that remain of the Civic Center are City Hall, the Civil Court Building, and the library. The other buildings fell victim to Katrina. Those two buildings, the State Office Building and the Supreme Court, were on Duncan Plaza, which survives. Duncan Plaza was the open space element of the Civic Center project.
So when you start to put an exhibit like this together, how do you go about it? Where do you start?
Well, fortunately, I had been working there for 32 years, so I have a pretty good idea of what the source material was. And we had done bits and pieces of this exhibit. We had done an exhibit on the history of the library itself some years ago. So, you know, that part of it was, I knew where to look for information about the library itself. We had done an exhibit on the city budget a number of years ago. So I knew, you know, something about the history of the Civic Center. And, you know, just things that I had run across over the years. But the interesting thing about it was, you know, I wanted to look beyond the Civic Center at some of the other neighbors. Obviously, the Pythian Temple was an important part of the whole story. Across the street, across Tulane Avenue, had been the Eye, Ear, Nose, and Throat Hospital for, you know, almost 100 years before it was, well, they moved out first and then the buildings were demolished. And then I got to thinking about the wider neighborhood. And, you know, knowing that the black district, the black counterpart to the more famous Storyville red light district of the 1890s, early 1900s, was adjacent to actually part of Duncan Plaza, just made me realize that a lot of history has happened within a few blocks of the library. Mm-hmm. And why not let people know about it? The other thing that kind of influenced me, I guess, was just all the new residential development that's been going on and it's continuing to go on in the immediate area and all of these new people who will be moving into the library's neighborhood. And I thought it was an opportunity maybe for them to learn something about where they're living and maybe even pull them into the library so that they can see the exhibit and
learn
about the library, right. So that was part of the idea.
So tell us a little bit about the history of the library itself, the main branch.
The main library was opened in 1958. I guess it was the last of the Civic Center buildings to open. Actually, it was kind of an afterthought. I don't think they originally intended to put the library there. There was talk earlier on of putting a high-rise parking garage where the library is. But they eventually decided to site the library there. It went on the site of the old criminal court building and the parish prison, which was behind the court building, which was right on the corner of Basin and Common, or Basin and Tulane. And the street names changed. What was Basin is now Loyola, but it was Saratoga in between. And what was Common is now Tulane. Saratoga was a narrow street, a typical, you know, CBD street. After they tore the criminal court building down in 1950, they widened the street to create Loyola Avenue. The Mayor Morrison, mm-hmm. who was the instigator of the whole Civic Center concept, wanted to have this grand vista down Loyola Avenue to City Hall. So you had to knock out a bunch of buildings to make that happen. So the library wound up being on part of the site of the courthouse. But the street itself, the widened street, was also a major part of where the courthouse had been. So the city had to buy other land on the other side of the courthouse in order to make enough room for the library. Then in later years, the library bought the old Trailways bus station, which had been there for a long time, with the idea of expanding into that. Right now, it's only a parking area, but who knows, someday maybe they'll find it on money to actually build a new wing or a new addition to the library. That was always the hope.
Always. Still the hope sometimes, you know. So much of our city's history is tucked away in those fabulous archives at the library.
Well, we do have a fabulous archives, and it's wonderful that we're one of many fabulous archives within the city. New Orleans is extremely fortunate that we have such a rich archival tradition, and also that very little of it suffered from Katrina. We are still absolutely amazed that our archives exist 18 feet below sea level in the basement of the main library, and the basement did not flood after Katrina.
We should be knocking on wood right now.
Yeah, every anniversary. we celebrate that fact. One of the things that I have always, you know, emphasized and taken some pride in is the fact that because it's the city archives is the basis for our collection, we do have other things, but the city archives is the reason that we exist as a special collection.
And that was actually mandated in the city charter.
Yeah, 1946 is when they actually passed an ordinance transferring it to the library, and then that became part of the charter in 1954. Mm-hmm. Because it's the city archives, it documents the citizens of the city. It does not document the rich people of the city. It does not document the people of a certain religion. It does not document the more educated people in the city. It makes an attempt to document everybody who lived here in the way that they interacted with their government.
And it's so great that it's just available to anyone.
Yeah, and it's available to anyone who comes in. And also, we've been making a big effort since 1995 to put it online. We were one of the first institutions of any kind in the city to develop a website, and we've been putting a lot of effort into it all this time. It's a pretty good website. I take some pride in it because
yes,
I started it. But Irene Wainwright has continued as the archivist and also as the webmaster, so to speak, keeping the whole thing alive. So anyway, people are finding things that we have in the city archives all over the world through the website. And some of them actually do come in to do research in person, too.
Well, it's a treasure. We've been talking with Wayne Everard, curator of From Common and Basin to Tulane and Loyola, 150 Years of Change in Our Neighborhood. Historian Keith Weldon Medley will present a talk on the history of the Pythian Temple building in conjunction with the exhibit Wednesday, September 17th at 6:30 at the Main Library Auditorium. Thank you so much, Wayne.
Thank you for having me, Susan.
Great things about living in an old city is that we have bookstores that have stood the test of time. Last weekend, we celebrated one of those great landmarks that rarely comes along, a bookstore's 50th birthday. Maple Street Bookshop is special to me for many reasons, not the least because it was the first New Orleans bookshop I ever visited, back in 1985, before my husband and I moved here. Rhoda Faust still owned the store then, having taken it over from her mother. She introduced me to Sheila Bosworth that day in that helpful way that booksellers have, making connections between people and books. That was my introduction to New Orleans. The local chain has expanded and contracted since then, expanded to a children's shop, shops at Lakeside and Old Metairie and Bayou St. John and St. Claude, two shops, one new, one used on Maple Street, and now back to one. In recent years, Donna Allen bought the store from Rhoda, and now it's in the hands of Gladden Scott, a man who loves books. And yes, Cindy Dyke is still there dispensing her wisdom, not only about children's books, but life in general. So many community memories are associated with Maple Street. Remember that Visa commercial featuring storyteller Colleen Sally, or Rhoda's affection for Walker Percy's work, or the Harry Potter parties there? A half century is a remarkable achievement in bookselling, and we should all celebrate it. Maple Street isn't the only bookstore with such a long history, of course. Community Book Center is celebrating 30 years in business this year. Faubourg Marigny Art and Books turns 37. But the granddaddy of them all is the Catholic Bookstore, which celebrates 75 years this fall. The new kid on the bookselling block is Tubby & Coo's Mid-City Bookshop. Candace Huber is the proprietor, a Dominican girl who took a detour into the world of IT and computers before following her passion into bookselling. Tubby & Coo's is named for her grandparents, and the store reflects Candace's passion for genre fiction, with mysteries and romances and science fiction and fantasy. It's bedecked with fanciful murals. Even the staircase looks like a stack of books, and the titles are Huber's favorites. There are floating bookshelves on the wall leading upstairs, and under the stairs, don't miss it, is a perfect Harry Potter nook. Candace calls her shop a dream come true, something that's true of most bookstores. The pleasures of indie bookstores are many and varied. The knowledgeable staff, the pleasure of being a regular, the diverse and idiosyncratic collection of books, with the sense that everything has been carefully chosen by an organizing intelligence or a strong personality. Our New Orleans booksellers are great characters, too. They love their city. They have strong recommendations about what to see and where to eat, in addition to what to read. Knowing about New Orleans is their stock in trade. So here's to Maple Street Bookshop, marking half a century, and to Tubby and Coo's Mid-City Bookshop just starting out. You enrich our neighborhoods with your presence, just as you enrich our lives with your books and friendship. Happy birthday and happy beginnings, and many more. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Jasmine Ward signs her memoir, Men We Reaped, Tuesday, September 16th at 6:30 at Garden District Bookshop. The Great Books Discussion Group discusses The Virtues by John Dewey, Tuesday, September 16th at 7 at the Old Metairie Branch Library. Sally Asher signs Hope and New Orleans, A History of Crescent City Street Names, Wednesday, September 17th at 6 at the 1850 House Museum Shop, 523 St. Anne. Today's guest, Wayne Everard, curator of From Common and Basin to Tulane and Loyola, 150 Years of Change in Our Neighborhood, will be on hand at a reception for the new exhibit Wednesday, September 17th at 6:30 in the Main Library Auditorium. Historian Keith Weldon Medley will present a talk on the history of the Pythian Temple Building. The Young Leadership Council and One Book, One New Orleans sponsor a benefit party for Louisiana Books to Prisoners, Thursday, September 18th from 5:30 to 7:30 at Cluett Gardens on Cluett Street between Royal and Dauphine. Allison Lane reads Uncle Arnell and the Swamp Witch, Thursday, September 18th at 6 at the Algiers Regional Library. Today's guest, Nancy Goldstone, author of The Maid and the Queen, The Secret History of Joan of Arc, will be the featured speaker at the 5th Annual Salon de Jeanne d'Arc Luncheon, along with Amy Kirk Duvoisin, founder and crew captain. The event takes place Saturday, all day long from 11 to 4, September 20th. That's at the Dana Center at Loyola University. To register for lunch, everything else is free, check out joanofarcparade.com. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses The Good Lord Bird by James McBride, Saturday, September 20th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Ralph Adamo reads from and signs his new poetry collection, Ever, Sunday, September 21st at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. And don't miss the banned books reading, Monday, September 22nd at 6 at the Main Library at 219 Loyola. Some of the readers who will be reading from their favorite banned books are Thomas Beller, Nancy Dixon, Bill Lavender, Constance Adler, Nevada Barr, Amanda Boyden, Maurice Ruffin, Bill Lofelm, Rebecca Snedeker, Kim Marie Voss, Stephanie Grace, and Library Executive Director Charles Brown. Don't miss it. Jefferson Parish Libraries will observe Banned Books Week with an exhibit at the East Bank Regional Library, September 21st through 27th. Michael Rubin reads from and signs his novel, The Cotton Crest Curse, Tuesday, September 23rd at 6 at Octavia Books. Peter Apodee discusses and signs Green in Judgment, Cold in Blood, Tuesday, September 23rd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Three authors of new children's books discuss and sign their works Tuesday, September 23rd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. They are Christy Johnson Rice, author of When the Lights Went Out in the City, Laura Dragon, author of Hurricane Boy, and Kristen Hedgepath, author of This Day. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.